So let's move on to really what I want to focus on today, which, as you can see on the slide there, effectively brings into play the whole notion of this curious character who emerged very much fully formed in the 1980s, part of George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, Indiana Jones. And anybody not heard of Indiana Jones? Anybody not seen an Indiana Jones movie? That's good, that's okay, right. That's TV series, read an Indiana Jones book, played an Indiana Jones game. The reason I'm mentioning that is because it really crosses over not just the topic of what we're discussing in this whole module, which is science fiction in film and television, but it also ties into some other classic notions which probably cross over into some of Andrew Elliott's work, but at the same time, from our perspective within film and television and science and fiction, it's very much this whole notion of the hero syndrome. And I've deliberately said hero as opposed to heroine for reasons which hopefully will become self-evident, although it's worth noting that from a gender perspective, you can begin to apply many of the kind of tropes that I've been talking about here when you start looking at certainly Terminator Dark Fate, other issues relating to contemporary sort of characters such as Ripley in the Alien franchise, and so on and so forth, quite apart from characters from a mythological perspective like Wonder Woman and Harley Quinn, and so on and so forth. Although, again, I think Harley Quinn's less mythological, more kind of contemporary response. So what do we actually mean, and why use that term? You know, paradigm and syndrome. He's used two sort of interesting lines there. Paradigm, very much a sort of research pattern, a way in which we actually work through that. Syndrome, a kind of collection of tropes and things that work together. Well, by that, I'm relating very much, and again, reiterating this, it's a kind of common theme that's well worth using as a technique when you're analysing text and you're looking at sort of the film and television side of things. We're looking at what is happening in the culture at the time period that things have emerged from. Whether or not it's looking backwards, or whether or not it's looking forwards, or whether it's set in a kind of alternate reality. But certainly what you're taking place, and what you take from Indiana Jones, is this character emerged very much from the 1980s. He's kind of very much a part of that whole essence, even though, of course, the whole element of Indiana Jones is set pre-World War II in the initial phases. Certainly the first three movies are all sort of pre-World War II, and it's not really until Crystal Skull that effectively you get into the Cold War era of the 1950s, and again the subsequent one that's in production, again, it's probably going to be set slightly further into the future. But you're looking at times where there's cultural aspects that people can relate to and acknowledge. And what's happening in the 1980s? Well, effectively, you have the demise of the Soviet Empire, the invasion of Afghanistan, you have the somewhat right-wing policies of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, you have Mikhail Gorbachev, who, interestingly enough, interviewed by the BBC yesterday, was saying that we could all be doomed if we don't get rid of nuclear weapons and avoid mass proliferation of nuclear weapons as well, and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of, there's a global aspect. We've also got something where certainly the Second World War is within living memory, certainly of parents, if not children. So there is an awareness of what is has been part of the culture and so on. And the notion of the battles of the Second World War are still relatively recent. In the same way as for folks such as yourselves, maybe you will remember, well, you may not remember, you probably won't remember 9/11, but you will certainly know the sort of notion, you know, people who will kind of remember the sort of the Twin Towers and the concern and the war on terror and other areas within that. One of the things that George Lucas in particular developed with respect to this whole notion was what I refer to as instant saga. You know, just add celluloid and bang, there's your magic that's actually there. And the same thing as he'd actually done with Star Wars, which of course was retitled Episode 4, A New Hope. You launch the viewer right back, slap bang into the middle of the actual saga itself. And an excerpt that we'll be looking at today, which was indeed the second movie in the franchise, The second movie in the serial is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and it's been subtitled as Chapter 23. And it wasn't actually, you know, again, as we see this thing in terms of production, the aspects and things that came through, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which of course was the first Indiana Jones movie which launched the whole popularity thing, was originally given the sort of notion of Chapter 24. So as you can see there, the sequel is indeed narratively a prequel. So Temple of Doom actually takes place before Raiders of the Lost Ark in chronological time. So we're already seeing those. And what happened before then? Well, again, lots of sort of exciting things. Certainly the third in the trilogy, as it was in the 1980s, was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And indeed ended with our heroes riding off into the sunset in a classic Western trope of that's how the thing actually ends, etc. You've got Chapter 23, Chapter 24, Chapter 25, anything else can be fitted in. I don't think there was initially a thought of actually doing a 9-film series, which is what Lucas at various times claimed was always the case with Star Wars. Not expecting it to not be completed until 2019, but at the same time, this sort of Indiana Jones thing is still looking at developing that whole notion of on-screen mythologies, on-screen stories and on-screen structures, which themselves had very much got their own roots in the kind of experiences that Lucas and Spielberg would have had watching Saturday morning TV serials, possibly Saturday morning film clubs, which would show Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, the Mask of Zorro, Robin Hood, all of these kind of characters and creature people would be sort of short, 15, 20 minute sort of adventure things, always with a cliffhanger ending, designed to make you come back for more, buy your ticket for more, and so on and so forth. I asked the question, had anybody seen the TV series, because it lasted for a couple of seasons in the 90s, sort of 80s and 90s, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, in which Indiana Jones encountered a large number of historical characters like Charlie Chaplin, like Winston Churchill, like Albert Einstein, and so on and so forth. So you're getting this whole universe which kind of we sort of recognise from our own, and yet it's not quite our own, because it's again, and I think, you know, the very sort of notion of Indiana as a middle American state, as a line that works through that, it all sort of adds to the iconography of what we're seeing and how we're seeing them developed, etc. There are over 150 novels and stories and paperbacks and things that you can get online, or indeed in hard copy, if you wish to really get into your Indiana Jones mythology. You know, everything from his work with aliens, through his biblical connections, through all sorts of other aspects are related to this Indiana Jones phenomenon. So as I said, it's more a case. I mean, we this year we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of Marvel Comics, which again has worked its way through a whole range of things. Batman is up 81, 82 now, and likewise Superman from DC. So again, you're getting this is something which, you know, Jones was kind of almost jumping straight in to something which was very much seen as fully formed and developed. But where were his influences? Who were his influences? Who were his antecedents? Who'd actually, you know, structurally paved the way for what we actually see as the hero in development? And when I speak about hero, then certainly the number one go-to text that I think is essential is Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. Lucas himself has said he made lots of reference to this in terms of his Star Wars saga. And likewise, with respect to Indiana Jones, this notion that fundamentally it doesn't really matter which culture we're coming from, we're still seeing the same kind of narrative structure being developed. We're still seeing the same kind of stereotypical characteristics that are being manifested. And we like it. We like that repetition. We like that familiarity. We might like to play around with some of that familiarity and consume it different ways, but it's still seen very much as something which is fundamental to our experience as human beings and so on. In other words, you're tapping into what can best be referred to as mythological archetypes. Whether we're talking about Norse mythology, whether we're talking about Aborigine, African, Chinese, Western European, Eastern European, similar kind of things are being developed within this. You're seeing a similar overriding story. It's the old notion that, you know, there are only seven basic storylines that you've actually got. Or as Vladimir Propp said in Morphology of the Folktale, you know, you can actually boil down the key aspects. He looked at over 1,000 Russian and Eastern European folktales and found the same kind of things were being manifest in all other sort of things that are actually there. How boring, you might say. Well, it depends. I mean, they're only, you know, in your average musical scale. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. You know, just a range of sort of numbers there and characteristics, so you can work all sorts of musical things there. And we only have four bases of DNA, so it's the way those things are combined and changed and adjusted that maybe opens up an aspect of other side of things. If you want to delve deeper and actually sort of dig further down, I would highly recommend, and it is online for a remarkably low price, I think about $2.99 as opposed to the hard copy, which I think is probably out of print now. A writer called Philip Jose Farmer, who's probably best known in the science fiction world as somebody who was one of the first science fiction writers to introduce explicit sex to his science fiction writing. And certainly his Riverworld series, which tells the tale of a world in which effectively all of humanity is resurrected. And it's literally just a long river, and the way in which he worked through that has had various attempts at filmmaking. There was a Hallmark series on Riverworld a few years ago that actually worked with that. But Philip Jose Farmer, in Doc Savage, his apocalyptic life really starts evolving and expanding. Next pop quiz question for you. Who is Doc Savage? Sorry. The Man of Bronze. Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze, and Clark Savage Jr., who actually became Doc Savage, have no fear, the Man of Bronze is here, was a highly popular pulp fiction character of the early 1930s. You could say that Superman is probably connected to the sort of Doc Savage issue, not only in terms of Clark Savage Jr., but also in terms of where does Doc Savage do the best of his work for humanity? His Fortress of Solitude. How does he, where does he relate? He lives in Midtown Manhattan, he lives in the whole thing there, he has a team of associates and so on. There are a number of parallels in terms of that. And there are a wealth of Doc Savage books in which you have Doc Savage meets the Shadow, and a whole variety of things. There's also a very underrated movie by George Powell, who we will be seeing another example of George Powell's work tomorrow with The Time Machine. But George Powell actually, in 1975, produced what he hoped would be a whole new series of movies to be similar to James Bond and others in terms of length, duration and popularity, starring Ron Ely, best known at that stage for his role as the television incarnation of Tarzan in the lead character. And it is actually not a bad movie. Again, you can access it on Amazon. You could look at Doc Savage. It's about 90 minutes. But it, and certainly it's always begging for a sequel, but it just didn't take off. Now, whether that was because it was out of time in 1975 and people say they don't want something that harks back to the 1930s, whether it was a case of certainly the Star Wars phenomenon hadn't struck then, so it was 2 years before Star Wars hit in 77, and indeed Superman, the Alexander Salkind version in 1978, so maybe it just came about at the wrong time. However, Doc Savage is undeniably really one of the root characters, if you're looking at analysing the kind of things that we're talking about in terms of Indiana Jones, which is absolutely essential. And actually what Farmer does in Doc Savage, his apocalyptic life, is he starts to draw some wonderful genealogical trees which relates Clark Savage to Amanda Grayson, to Sherlock Holmes, to Lord Greystoke, kind of prefiguring what Alan Moore did with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So a lot of fictional characters. In the case of Amanda Grayson, obviously, one of the relatives of Dick Grayson, and also, you know, a predecessor of the Amanda Grayson, of course, married Sarika Vulcan to become the mother of Spock. So you're really looking at, again, almost a kind of fantasy, really, in which you have a whole genealogical line of characters from both hard science fiction, as I mentioned, Star Trek and so on, sci-fi, spy-fi, James Bond and others, all being interconnected within this whole system. And it's kind of Hosei Farmer's line of saying how not only do they share sort of similar narrative lines, but the reason they share those similar narrative lines is because they're all related in some way, shape or form. Or there is a connection from that. So it's quite fun from that point of view. And again, clearly sort of impacts in terms of obviously Indiana Jones. And as I mentioned a few moments ago, in an era where we are instructed by Netflix that you can now watch your series at 1.5 times the speed by simply speeding through, no, please don't tell me you're going to do that. I've got a binge watch. I'm sorry, it's a binge watch. I'll just watch it 1.5 times the speed. I put that actually over the weekend to Andrew Lee Potts, who was known for his work on Primeval, when I was interviewing him live on stage in Great Yarmouth. You can download the podcast if you wish. His response was, you must be joking, but it is obvious. I mean, have you heard that story about Netflix that put it out last week? Anybody here actually think that's a good idea? What would you think? Yeah, you do. Why?
It depends on what you're watching.
I mean, you can do it as a matter of course, and I'm sure people do fast forward and flick through it, but as I used to with commercials, yes.
I just try watching Battle for the Nation in full speed. I won't play. Two fives that on YouTube, and it was much more better.
So you'd say it's much better to actually watch it at its speeded up version.
Silence in the mouth of the packet.
Okay. Prepare to come to major grips and fights with a lot of filmmakers who say, no! I mean, I sort of got a certain sympathy-ish, but it's... Yeah, I mean, I think there's also something in terms of... I mean, Professor Brian Winston is very angry if screenings take place and we don't actually make people sit until the very last credits are moved. And I say, that's fine, but sometimes you've got a lot of credits. Okay. However... Saturday Adventure matinees were something which were highly popular, and as I mentioned, they would feature popular Batman. If you look at 1940s Batman in the cinema, Superman, etc., they'd all kind of emerge as cheap, relatively cheap, early sort of TV series. But then again, it was sort of lined from that, but except they weren't TV series, they were matinees which had, as I say, a notion of being a whole series of serials, not too dissimilar to, indeed, classic Doctor Who and so on. And you're also emerging, not from the Quentin Tarantino movie, although actually the reason he called his movie Pulp Fiction was because he was nodding an homage to the era of Pulp Fiction, in which cheap, relatively... lurid and somewhat easy to read material was being produced, basically because whether you're looking for gangsters, westerns, horror, science fiction, these are cheap entertainment ways which, from a hardboiled detective story right the way through to contemporary science fiction will all sort of relate to jobbing authors, writers who are paid by the word, who we might well look back sometimes with awe and say, oh, that was wonderful. But at the time, they were just churning the stuff out as quickly as they could to get as much money as they could. A bit like filmmakers make horror movies today because they're cheap and cheerful. Well, not so cheerful, but they can. You're doing stuff from that point of view. So somewhere between that whole selection, you've got the sort of background to Indiana Jones and so on. And, of course, Skywalker Ranch, Skywalker films... the alter ego of George Lucas himself. The man who has had a modicum of success, I think you say, with respect to not necessarily his work with THX 1183, which is a fine movie, well worth seeing, or indeed American Graffiti, but certainly hit the jackpot with respect to Star Wars, despite the fact that, as critics at the time said, and it's a well-worn argument, the problem with Star Wars was because it was such a huge success... it basically kind of meant that a lot of interesting movies that were being made in the 70s, like A Boy and His Dog, like Logan's Run, like Silent Green, and so on, we don't really see much of these days. We kind of have seen a bit of a renaissance in terms of Sci-Fi London and Sci-Fi London Film Festival. But you have to dig a little bit deeper to find some of the more interesting science fiction, which isn't the populist, major sort of blockbuster fare. that is actually around from that point of view. But again, that's another issue for another debate and so on. So these are some of the books that you can access in terms of Indiana Jones and his experiences and so on. In terms of, again, you can access them online, you can spend all sorts of things working through the process and seeing a whole range of sort of elements within that. And what's coming through in terms of that? Well, look at the titles. The Genesis Deluge. The Interior World. The Unicorn's Legacy. The Hollow Earth. The Dance of the Giants. The Sky Pirates. The Cup of the Vampire. All of these are basically carrying with it connotations of classic characters and folk who are actually there. Again, another chap I was spending time with over this weekend event in Ray Yarmouth was Dacre Stoker, D-A-C-R-E. Dacre is the great-grandson of Bram Stoker, known obviously as the creator of Dracula. He's written a novels with respect to that whole side of things. And I, obviously, being true to the notion that I'm representing the University of Lincoln, I need to flag this up. I actually asked Dacre, so if his... Bram had been around today, what would he have made of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer? Classic movie, I think, like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Anybody seen Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer? No. And he said he would have liked it, because actually Bram Stoker was a keen fan of Abraham Lincoln. And as well as obviously being somebody who wanted to obviously put the proverbial buttocks on seats, you know, and spend a lot of time with the great actor Henry Irving, you know, part of writing Dracula, part of developing that whole side of things, was to not only tap into the mythological elements of Gothic horror and so on, but also produce something which was contemporaneous with the equivalent of Jack the Ripper, which was taking place as Stoker was writing Dracula, and of course the sort of time in which there was a lot of fear of immigrants, there was a little concern about Orientalism. There was, as Edward Said would say, there was concern about the other, there was concern about Europe. So no change there then, really, in terms of the ways in which we're seeing these things being developed, etc. And certainly that whole notion of the biblical references to Genesis, the first book, the flood, the notion of the hollow earth theory, the unicorn, the mythological aspect of that, all tap into the whole area. And certainly The Sky Pirates, it's written by Martin Caden. Martin Caden was most generally recognised as the person who coined the term cyborg, which latterly was incarnated as the $6 million man, or some might say soon to be incarnated as the $6 billion man to allow for inflation between the 1970s and the present day, which also spun off in terms of the Bionic Woman as well. And obviously, again, Caden writing about this whole thing, so the whole sort of elements that come through within that field as well. And so on and so forth as well. So all of this goes into what I'm referring to as the synthesis of Indiana. The way in which, the synthesis is the opposite of analysis. Analysis is when you break things apart. Synthesis is when you put them back together, like photosynthesis. So you're kind of beginning to say, how is this being constructed? How is it being developed, etc.? Well, I have talked in the past about how you can see the Bible, or indeed the Quran, as being a science fiction text. Bible as in basic instruction booklet for the life experience. The whole element that comes across when you start talking about religious mythologies. Indeed, the very heart of Raiders of the Lost Ark is the Ark of the Covenant, which is at the fundamental foundation of the relationship between the Israelites, Moses, God, and so on. Relates that whole sort of package to that, the vengeful God, the God of the Israelites and so on, and allegedly the area that Adolf Hitler was fascinated by and invested huge sums of money in the 1930s in endeavouring to prove the significance of this lost treasure, this area that really would just support the theory of the master race, the Aryan super race and so on. We welcome sort of the Tutankhamun sort of exhibitions that come through here. And this whole notion of spending so much time on these icons of religion and so on and so forth. Whether it be, as I say, the whole notion of the Ark of the Covenant in terms of Raiders of the Lost Ark, or indeed the religious mythologies of India in terms of the Last Crusade, not the Last Crusade in terms of the Temple of Doom, or indeed the cup, the Holy Grail, you know, the ultimate Holy Grail, the last cup that was used as Jesus Christ transformed wine into water, water into wine, all connected with the Last Supper, all of those sort of aspects there. These are deeply rooted aspects, whatever your particular beliefs or thoughts with respect to religion. You know, whether you sort of are an atheist, an agnostic, a monotheist, a pantheist, whatever your kind of views happen to come on this basis, you also have these shared Jungian archetypes. The notion of how there are common theories that actually relate. You can look back at all of the sort of screens we've had so far, whether it be Interstellar, whether it be Event Horizon, whether you're connecting the excitement of the Land of the Giants with respect to Fantastic Voyage, you're all sort of exploring one level, and we're taken on that exploration to see how that relates to the notion that there's something bigger than all of us. There's a sort of an overall thing that actually is activating us. We are all, in the words of that Jerry Was a Man screening I showed a few weeks ago, you know, there's a little spark of the divine in all of us, right the way through the whole notion of how Michelangelo Sistine Chapel actually has the image of the spark of life coming from God to Adam and so on. And you are playing around, as I said, with a huge interrelationship of historical narratives, things that in our reality know actually happened, like the Second World War, like the Cold War, like the notion of UFOs and so on, or areas that are related to that, like presidential figures that we recognise, and fiction. Because Indiana Jones is not one of our real people in our reality. He is a fictional creation. But just as we see a lot of interrelationship, you know, in terms of places, names, I mean, it's interesting with DC that their superheroes are usually set in a world in which we sort of can say Metropolis is sort of New York, and we might be able to say that parts of like Gotham City, and we might be able to say that Central City is more kind of the equivalent to the notion of maybe San Diego or Seattle or areas along those sort of bases. But you know, there's no real sort of. Whereas obviously one of the things that Stan Lee was very keen on was to cite his superheroes in New York. In Los Angeles, in recognisable areas that people could connect with, and so on. So how does that fit into heroes? Well, is he? Is he not? Is she? Is she not? Is it a code? Is it a title? Undeniably, 25 films and counting, you know, with respect to the whole Bond franchise, it has been huge. It's still actually, I think, it's nip and tuck between Harry Potter and James Bond in terms of the most successful cinematic franchise. Actually, Avengers have sort of knocked them off the line from that. But you're still into this whole area of how, clearly, whatever one's viewpoint, James Bond, created by Ian Fleming, of course, in the 1950s, proved to be JFK's most favourite text, Casino Royale, and has, from the onset of the success of Dr. No, with Sean Connery, proven to be highly successful, although the first James Bond was actually Bob Holness, who used to actually host a quiz show called, not Countdown, it was Blockbusters, back in the day. You look it up on YouTube and so on. Bob Holness was a South African actor who played James Bond for radio in South Africa. But Bond, whether or not you've ever seen a Bond movie, hands up, have you never seen a Bond movie? So nobody's not seen a single one. So you've all seen at least one, but well, that's interesting. Okay, because but you still have an iconological notion of whether it's Daniel Craig, whether it's Pierce Brosnan, whether it's Timothy Dalton, whether it's Roger Moore, whether it's Sean Connery, whomever. I mean, there's a fascinating sort of spoof called Casino Royale, not the Daniel Craig Casino Royale, but one with David Niven and Deborah Carr and Orson Welles and Woody Allen, which is probably regarded as the worst movie ever. I don't think it's that bad, but it's worth looking at if you want to sort of see, well, what? How bad can this be? I mentioned it before, logical, but fictional. You know, again, I only had 1 year. I think it was a group of level one journalists, and somebody actually thought that Sherlock Holmes was real because obviously he lives in 221B Baker Street. Hopefully they went on to become more successful investigative journalists and realised no, they weren't. It was a fiction. Does anybody believe Sherlock Holmes is real? Yeah, no, that's not so. What? He's not real? Oh no! Lord Greystoke. Crossed over, of course, if you recall, for the superhero package I did a few weeks ago. And again, there are elements within that. Orphaned, yes. Costumes, well, after a fashion. Certainly, remember the sort of Bond costume of a tuxedo, because that would be particularly sort of relevant with respect to other aspects. And even Tarzan, up to a certain extent, also engages in terms of that costume sort of element, etc. Anybody heard of him?
Bagels. The guy with the goggles.
Well, he was a pilot, Air Force pilot, Bigglesworth, created by Captain W.E. Johns. Again, very popular in the sort of 1950s, 1960s. Soul movie, not quite in the same league as Doc Savage, but the kind of British equivalent. And again, if you look at sort of the adventures of Biggles, you'll find that, together with his faithful friend Algy and others, is quite interesting. But also, I suppose you'd have to turn around and say these days, not necessarily the most PC of individuals in terms of his views about Britain and the Empire and so on, but there we are. There's, of course, the good man of bronze. And indeed, who knows what evil lurks within men's hearts? The shadow knows. All of which, again, are popular examples of heroes doing their stuff, keeping the world safe, and in terms of time and so on, it's interesting. Discussing the whole essence of Robin Hood as well. Richard Dinnick, who's produced a whole range of texts for both the new version of Lost in Space, for Sapphire and Steel, for the current Doctor, and indeed the Matt Smith incarnation of Doctor Who, is currently looking at a sort of notion of a teenage version of Robin Hood. So it's sort of Rob before we actually sort of gather together, looking at sort of prequel. And it's been kind of greenlit as a series with a couple of provisos. One, of course, being that he needs to actually have the characters using mobile phones. But he said it's set in the 14th century. There weren't any mobile phones in the 14th century. I don't care, they said. We want mobile phones in there. So, his response after due consideration, whether this actually goes to full series, you'll know in the matter of time, you can remember you heard it here first, it's quite an interesting, it certainly would be published as a book, is he's positing that the Roman Empire never actually fell, and so what actually happens is an alternate reality, that actually phones have developed to a stage that because radio is in essence a relatively simple aspect of technology to grow through. If there was never a Dark Ages and the Roman Empire had maintained, they would undoubtedly have actually discovered the whole aspect of primitive radio systems, so the characters would be using kind of primitive versions of, sort of old bricks and phones and ways to actually communicate with each other. But that's not historically factual, at least from our perspective. But it's still making use of, again, the various manifestations of Robin Hood himself, who has been through a number of key words, whether it's a case of the aspect of the mythological, the more kind of aspect of the spirit of the forest, the spirit of Englishness, and so on and so forth, the notion of justice, all of those things emerging. And a character whose initials kind of tend to give him away is created by Leslie Charteris, partly as, again, as a pulp response, had huge success with Roger Moore in the 1960s, and then latterly with Ian Ogilvy, and a movie with Val Kilmer, and then there was another movie which also co-starred Elijah Dushku, which didn't quite work. It was the last sort of piece that Roger Moore had actually done before he actually sort of passed a few years ago. St. The Saint, Simon Templar, the Knights Templar, the sort of aspect that comes across from that. I mean, I've deliberately sort of selected Tarzan, Sherlock, James Bond, Biggles, Robin Hood, and Simon Templar, because they are classic British heroes. Sometimes people say, it's all American. No. Bear in mind that we sometimes have this sort of cross-fertilisation of areas that come through, all of which echo that hero notion. And given that Indiana Jones, like Star Wars, is a movie series that's been made predominantly in Britain, and evidences that special relationship, as I was saying a few weeks ago, with respect to the Nemesis Syndrome and so on. I think it's worth noting how those characters are developed and shown as well. So, let's draw a few other parallels between three particular franchises. But, you might be thinking, James Bond is not science fiction. Well, you're into those grey areas. Moonraker, I'd say, is hardcore science fiction. You Only Live Twice, likewise. The gadgets, the areas that come through within the whole essence of Bond and so on, tends to cross over slightly, although there's been clearly an attempt in the reboot under Daniel Craig to focus more. But Die Another Day, An Invisible Car, not science fiction, really? I think not. Again, you've got areas that come through in terms of that. So, and I've deliberately put Bond in the middle, at the sort of the other elements of Jones on one side and Star Wars at the other, because there is a clear sort of evidence here of how things are developed and presented to us. First of all, from the point of view of the production base alone, these are co-productions. You know, without the American money funding the British technicians and the lines of things that were being done, you would not have had any of those three particular franchises getting past step one. You know, British film technicians, fantastic, but we don't have the finance to effectively sort of invest hugely in terms of the film industry. That's, and I'm sure I'm hopefully sort of treading old ground here that you'll have covered in other aspects of the degree. But the bulk of the money in terms of Western movies, and I'm specifically working on that basis, Hollywood as opposed to Bollywood, as opposed to other Eastern countries, etc., for the British American sort of system comes primarily from the States and so on. We have the interrelationship in terms of Indiana himself as a character and Han Solo as a character, both portrayed obviously by Harrison Ford. Both obviously having a sidekick. Ooh, sidekick, that's like a superhero. Yeah, sidekick in terms of Chewbacca in the case of Han Solo. And who's the sidekick though in the case of Indiana Jones? Well, I would go on to say that that's where you start looking at the female of each particular episode, which I think is particularly interesting again in terms of names. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, the heroine is Marion Ravenwood, who obviously made a return in a recent edition of Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull as well from that point of view. Again, I do not want to insult your intelligence by saying, who was Robin Hood's best mate? Well, there we are, Marion. Who are we talking about? Well, we're talking about Raven Wood. You've got a whole notion of the raven, the wood, the sort of notion of the forest, etc. You know, putting together the names, the structure of that is very much part of the whole sequence. In the Temple of Doom, Willie, is that a name? Is that Wilhelmina? Is it Bill, etc.? It's a deliberately androgynous name in a certain sense for this torch singer, this ditzy blonde torch singer, who is the first person that we actually see in terms of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, in terms of the opening sequence that we're going to be talking through in a few moments. And then in the third instance, well, I think there's no doubt ultimately that if you call Elsa Schneider and you're dealing with a movie that basically is looking at possibly Nazis as well, there's a possibility that this blonde woman in The Last Crusade, or The Last Crusade, is indeed not necessarily the best intentioned individual and so on. But again, you're seeing that sort of wonderful passage of ways in which these characters are developed. And would it be a Spielberg movie if you didn't have some childlike sense of wonder to the full? Because from Close Encounters of the Third Kind right the way through arguably the majority of his work, Spielberg does tend to relate to children, probably not in a scary Michael Jackson sense, although that's another whole issue. More in the sort of sense of how we see them being portrayed or how they're developed on camera. In, for instance, Raiders of the Lost Ark, of course, where you don't have any junior characters as such, you could make a very good case for saying that ultimately we all were children. Because, as I said, the whole essence of Raiders of the Lost Ark is it's the Ark of the Covenant, and it's effectively the notion of God making a pact with human beings, that he would not strike us down, that he would work through this. So it's all of humanity would be seen as the children of God, and the light from that. more explicitly, in the Temple of Dune, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, we see the character of Short Round. And we also see, some might say, a certain reference to J.M. Barrie here, the Lost Boys, the children who are kidnapped to work in the mines for the benefit of, obviously, the thuggy cult, and the cult that's actually sort of being there as the evildoers with respect to, obviously, India and so on. Also tying in very much to cultural relevance questions and so on. And in The Last Crusade, in terms of the first trilogy, you have the notion of, well, Sean Connery appears as Indiana's father. And again, you don't have to be a massive film buff to turn around. So, Sean Connery, Indiana Jones' father? What was that about? Yeah, all connected there. So you have Henry Jones Sr. So you're seeing that the child, in all sense of the words, at all stages of development, in certainly these three movies as well from that point of view. So let's consider a few sort of general sort of aspects which are commonalities throughout, again, which we'll go on to drill down a little bit more into in a few moments. Well, I've already cited The Lost Boys, and you could say that maybe we're in this sort of position of dealing with the Peter Pan complex, which is something that it's fair to say that Philip Pullman would find very distasteful and deeply concerning. I don't know if anybody saw the BBC 4 documentary on Philip Pullman following his Dark Materials yesterday, but again, it's interesting that his views were that he wanted to ensure that certainly writers like C.S. Lewis and J.M. Barrie with respect to Peter Pan, that somehow this notion that there's an endless childhood that is somehow uncorrupted was actually not just fundamentally flawed, it was also ideologically quite dodgy. You know, you need to actually have a situation whereby people are allowed to grow. You know, part and parcel of children. Children want to become adults, often as soon as possible. You know, that process, that pattern, which is what certainly the Lyra Balakwa character in his Dark Materials is seen as somebody who's, you know, she's going through it. That's why we're seeing in the first trilogy, you know, the notion of how she works through that. The second trilogy, which is just the second book, has been published this year. Again, you're seeing how the developments are coming through within that. And yet, is there some sort of part of us which actually hankers and harkens back to and really sort of wishes to still have those childlike impulses where everything was innocent, you know, where it was all new and the tooth fairy and the Easter bunny and Santa Claus were all part and parcel of the rich tapestry. Before anybody says anything, has he just said Santa Claus doesn't exist? I haven't said anything of the sort. Just, you know, say keep childhood things. But it is, it's relating to that notion of a never-ending childhood. Childhood that never sort of goes anywhere. Again, for those people interested in the original Star Trek series, I would point you in the direction of an episode entitled Miri, M-I-R-I, Miri, which was actually banned by the BBC for about 25 years because they claimed it actually showed an unfortunate scene in a classroom in which small children are whacking James T. Kirk in his role as the teacher, you know, quite brutally on the head, etc. Scary stuff. Don't get any ideas. Anyway. All three relate in Jungian terms to what we would say would be inner voyages of self-discovery. Sort of thing we talked about in terms of inner space and outer space. In order to really appreciate what's going on deep down, outer space, inner space, you need to effectively find out who are you on that journey. It's something that Joseph Campbell certainly relates to. You know, the whole point about Hero of a Thousand Faces is not somebody who wakes up in the morning and decides when they go through the walk-through wardrobe, which face shall I wear today? Shall I be two-faced, three-faced, etc.? No, these are kind of experiences that effectively are unique to ourselves as individuals. How we grow, how we develop, how we mature, how we actually sort of encounter whole new areas of aspects. Whether that's in pursuit of something, so there is a quest, we're actually looking for the princess, we're looking for the Holy Grail, we're actually looking for the elements that, you know, make up the whole sort of sequence of various other aspects as well. Again, it's how things are developed and enhanced from that point of view. And I already mentioned this earlier. Westerns were a very, very popular genre. Yeah, they've never quite gone away. They probably never will go away. But certainly the notion of the Western in space, we looked again a few weeks ago, Spectre of the Gun, at how You know, one example, Firefly, is another classic example of how Joss Whedon, you know, was using the Western motif within that. And it's not a huge leap of logic to say, oh, yes, well, what does Indiana Jones' headgear remind you of? You know, in terms of the fedora, the lines that are coming through within that whole system. The good guy, the white hat or the brown hat, the area that comes through with that as well. All tying into what we would see part and parcel of undergoing this search for aspects of self, aspects of other sort of areas, and so on and so forth. Or, in the words of an aspect of the first in the trilogy, Raiders of the Lost Ark, is it simply a case of making it up as they go along? Which is literally part of the elements that is said when Marion Ravenwood and the Indiana Jones character effectively emerge from the snake pit. Is it simply a case of making it up as they go along, and they've got into that whole sort of system? I mean, it's not unheard of. If you look at some of the making of systems with respect to James Bond, sometimes they'll storyboard, they'll make decisions all the time. It's literally, it's a case of happy good fortune and chance alone that will enable academics to 15, 20, 30, 40 years later say, what a profound statement that actually was. It just happened to be the shot that they took at the time, or were they guided by a more universal intelligence and so on. Okay, well, let's have a look at some of the evidence. Because obviously being good scholars of film and television studies, you're never going to just make a statement and say, yeah, there it is. You're going to look at why that is the case and why that might be the case. Well, certainly if we see how Temple of Doom developed, and again, I draw your attention to, if you have time, look at some of the additional sort of dialogue that's been produced with respect to that and material, you could see it as one big multi-platform role-playing video game, which starts off on a high and goes to up and down, and it's the literal roller coaster of a movie. Now, this is at a time where actually the whole video game franchise hadn't really taken off as such. Lara Croft hadn't really emerged in terms of the consciousness. We were probably talking about Super Mario Brothers, possibly Sonic the Hedgehog and so on. So you're looking at some of the sort of classics that are actually there, certainly not Call of Duty or any of the other sort of multimedia shootouts that are actually around. Halo, way before that, was there. But at the same time, that whole notion of multi-platform storytelling is certainly around and in the sort of zeitgeist, in the sort of element of how we see storytelling being worked, how we see storytelling being part of a way of, you've seen the movie, buy the paperback novel, buy the making of the series, buy the soundtrack album, etc., etc., etc. Merchandise always helps. Of course, one of the things and one of the challenges, whether it be Resident Evil, or indeed Halo, or indeed the Lego movie, although I think that's an honourable exception, because let's face it, everything is awesome. In terms of the notion of what we see there, are they genuinely well-rounded characters? Or are the characters of Willie Scott, Short Round, Indiana Jones, the Mr. Miyagi, are they all just simply stereotypical characters? You know that they're bad guys because you know that she's the good guy because etc., etc. Are they just sort of working well-worn sort of shortcuts that we've seen time and time again? How do gender roles interrelate and connect with what we're actually seeing here? How is the development put forward? Certainly, as we said, Marianne Ravenwood is the brunette. Willie Scott is blonde. So is Ilsa Schneider. Are they following in the lines of the notions of the femme fatale? The notion of the woman as the mysterious seductress? Or the adventurer? Or the soul who doesn't quite know what's happening? I mean, where are we seeing the sort of manifestations of the characters being put together? There are, historically, lots of examples in Hollywood about this, and there's just some of them that I've actually put up there. Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart into Have and Have Not. in the range that we actually have there in Casablanca. Obviously, the notions, I mean, that's not with Lauren McCall, but the whole notion of how that sort of manifested, the Carol Lombard, Clark Gable romance, Spencer Tracy and Catherine Hepburn in The African Queen. And the, you know, so these are women who were empowered long before it became fashionable in a woke, quote-unquote, society to actually talk about the whole thing. These are fundamentally an era where actually strong women roles were part and parcel of the Hollywood era. You know, from your Joan Crawfords, your Bette Davises. You know, I often sort of get a little bit concerned that when you have a situation, people say, oh, we're all woke now, it was all... No, we've actually been there before, we've actually been through a range of things, and if you look at the history of Hollywood, the best stories had strong female characters in them. So, again, worth noting that in an era where, obviously, with Star Wars, with respect to Princess Leia, and again, how she went through her own character development arc as well, you're not seeing something here whereby necessarily women are marginalised. It's an interesting line to discuss in terms of that. Or is it simply a case that we just want to tick that box as well and ensure that people aren't feeling left out, etc. And of course, the essence of drama is all to do with conflict. You have fundamentally the good versus evil line. And a good villain needs to be ideologically extreme. You expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. All critical in terms of what we're seeing, in terms of how things are. Reigniting Bond will become more clear in a few moments when I start picking a few other clips out from this. But we are talking about people who want to take over the world, take over the planet, run through the whole thing. We're not talking people who basically want to just, you know, steal a few pennies here, various other bits of these. These are hardcore villains. These are people who are, you know, clearly very much of the belief that they are the world conquerors, etc. They are Nazis, thuggies, Nazis, or in the case of the Crystal Skull, communists. You know, people who certainly are not good, upstanding, democratic American citizens. You know, it's quite clearly they are bad guys. You know, we would possibly have related them to maybe Native Americans, but that's a different issue for another time, for another day to be considered. Remember what I said about the notion of time, the 1980s? Ronald Reagan actually, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher both referred to the Soviet Union at that time as being the evil empire. So again, you're seeing this notion of how we are... basically, is it propaganda? Is it entertainment? Is it a case of it's a metaphor? Is it a classic case of science fiction as metaphor, science fiction as allegory, etc.? Or again, is that simply a case of, well, it's a nice way of actually working through that process? It's a nice way of getting to this stage where fundamentally, even if you've never seen an Indiana Jones movie, once you actually hear the notion of da 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 da, you know, it kind of becomes iconic, same as the bullwhip, the fedora, the kind of images that we actually start seeing within that whole system. What would Indiana Jones be if he didn't have major stubble on his cheeks and wasn't sort of, you know, really sort of not totally unshaven, but he'd been working so hard, he'd been stressed, etc. Something particularly interesting in terms of how we see him introduced in the Temple of Doom, which I think is quite intriguing as well. I've already spoken about the music. And it's also worth noting that one of the franchises that Spielberg always wanted to direct but never did, I suppose it's never too late, he's still with us, is that of James Bond. You know, that's one of the reasons he was quite keen on sort of working through this process. Who is not Bond, clearly. But also, just as with Bond, you need to suspend your disbelief. For somebody to actually do all the things the Indiana Jones is supposed to do as an ordinary, quote-unquote, human being? Don't know. But that's part of the fun. To die would be an awfully big adventure, to quote Peter Pan. You know, that whole notion of taking that whole leap into the unknown, isn't that part of why we like science fiction so much? That actually, if we suspend our disbelief for that moment when we are going around the black hole, when we are entering the event horizon, when we are actually sort of exploring that alien planet, isn't that part of the fun that we can somehow start saying, yes, when we're going into the microverse of the human being and we're actually, you know, on our micro sub and we're actually having to go through the chambers of the heart, etc., Is that not part of what we actually consider the fun, taking that leap of faith? And the future is always notoriously difficult to predict, but I think it's fair to say that there will still be more film narratives. So the fifth in the series probably is due out in the next 2 or 3 years or thereabouts. I mean, I think, you know, Harrison Ford still says, I'm still hanging on there and there. There will, of course, be more print adventures. And there's always that opportunity of the reboot. You know, we talked about some of the other icons that were actually there, things people like, the Saints, Bond, of course, who has been rebooted, Batman, inevitably, Superman. You know, again, that's what you do. If it makes money, you're not going to knock it. You might even try Doc Savage again, maybe, maybe not, who knows. And you can go to a website there to find out more details as well. So what I want to actually spend some time now doing is putting a little bit more flesh on those bones by doing a little bit of an internal analysis of Temple of Doom. I warn you, this is not going to be a kind of straight watch through. We'll sort of be going through a few key things. We'll probably only get maybe 10, 15 minutes in before sort of time will actually beat us. But clearly that in its own right is fairly iconic. You know, the image that we actually get there of a Paramount picture, it carries with it a lot of connotations, 80 years or so, obviously over 100 now, since we actually saw that particular image actually in form there. And as is the case with all Indiana Jones movies, Spielberg uses the notion of the mountain to launch us in, to segue into the first scene. It kind of sets that whole sequence. But the question I'm going to put to you at this particular stage is, as we watch this, as we watch this opening few minutes, is this what we would expect from an adventure movie called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? Okay, so there's your opening shot. We've obviously gone to Echoes of the Rank film industry, the man with the doll, the big gong from that point of view, and we know it's a Steven Spielberg movie, but what else is coming through? What's the music saying to us?
It almost looks like it's at the beginning of a musical.
Exactly, exactly. So again, assume no familiarity. You haven't even attended the last thing. First thing you can get here is this a musical? And can we actually dig a bit at what kind of musical?
I don't know, a Busby Berkeley.
Absolutely. And what was Busby Berkeley particularly famous for in terms of musicals?
Kind of the staging effects.
Staging and lots of dancing girls. Okay? That's the key thing. When were Busby Berkeley musicals in vogue? When were they really popular?
1930s.
Why were they really popular? What else is happening in the 1930s, apart from the growth of fascism? But that's partly part of it.
Decent sound in film, maybe.
Too sophisticated an answer, but you, a little bit more. What else is happening in the 30s outside of the cinema? Absolutely, the Great Depression. People, if they're going to shell out a few pennies, dollars, cents, whatever, at the cinema, they want to be entertained. They want escapism. And what you're getting with, obviously, sound quality, which is true, and various other things, and not necessarily colour, but this is obviously colour, is escapism. So, next thing is, pay attention. What are they actually about to be singing? What are they indeed singing as we listen to the whole thing develop?